The Greek philosopher Aristotle once wrote that the single most common denominator of mankind is the desire to be happy, however happiness may be defined by the individual. In his work, Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle wrote that the primary concern of philosophy was to answer the question, how shall we live in order to be happy? Virtually every action that you take in life is aimed at somehow achieving your own happiness or moving away from the people and circumstances that cause you to feel unhappy. Sigmund Freud called this the pleasure principle, and for him and for many psychologists and psychoanalysts, it became the foundation for studying the mental and emotional aspects of human behavior. It's safe to say that virtually everything you think or say or do is simply a means, the end of which is the achievement of your own happiness. The question of happiness and how to achieve more of it and how to avoid unhappiness has been studied exhaustively for hundreds of years. In this session, we'll talk about some of the laws that have been discovered in the universal search for happiness. You can then use these laws and principles to dramatically increase the level of happiness that you enjoy in virtually everything you do. As I mentioned earlier, the starting point of your achieving happiness is for you to decide exactly how you define the word happiness. As Stephen Covey writes, you must start with the end in mind. Begin with a goal and work back. You need to engage in the hard, disciplined thinking of deciding for yourself exactly what combination of ingredients causes you to feel the happiest about yourself most of the time. Remember, you are both unique and extraordinary. There's never been and never will be anyone exactly like you. You have a remarkable combination of tastes and values and beliefs and needs and desires that make your particular definition of happiness different from that of anyone else who has ever lived. And only you can decide for yourself what makes you happy. No one can ever dictate happiness to another person. It's a purely subjective or personal decision. When I think of how different happiness is to each person, I think of a large smorgasbord. Have you ever been to a long buffet line with 20 or 30 or even 40 different dishes of all kinds? If you ever want to see a living example of the differences between human beings, just stand for a short while at the exit end of a buffet line and look at the different combinations of foods that the individuals have put on their plates. You'll never see two exactly the same. The sizes, colors, proportions, and mixtures will be different for each person. This simple exercise is proof that neither you nor anyone else can ever decide what will make another person happy. For each person, this choice is his or her primary responsibility in life, and it's both mandatory and unavoidable. A useful and enjoyable exercise for you is to write down on a piece of paper the following line. I would be perfectly happy if. Then complete the sentence with as many different answers as you can think of. You might say, I would be perfectly happy if I had all the money I needed, if I enjoyed perfect health, if I had the love, respect, and esteem of all the people who are important to me, if I were living in the perfect climate, or if I was doing the perfect job, and so on. The more detailed your answers are, and the more you break your answers down into clear definitions of exactly what those answers mean, the easier it will be for you to organize your life in such a way that you enjoy far more happiness than the average person. The silliest thing about the concept of happiness is that, although everybody wants more of it, very few people have ever taken any time at all to decide for themselves what it really means to them. This is probably why most people are dissatisfied with much of their lives. Fortunately, you can free yourself from this tendency by clarifying for yourself exactly how each part of your life would be if you were a perfectly happy person already. In psychology, and as you will see in economics, the basic principle of human behavior is that all human action is motivated by a dissatisfaction of some kind. If a person was perfectly satisfied, he would have no urge or desire to do or change anything. So the starting point of achieving greater happiness for you can be an evaluation of some of the needs that you might experience which lead to dissatisfaction. Perhaps the most important work in this area was done by the psychologist Abraham Maslow when he postulated his hierarchy of needs. What he said was that each person has a series of needs from the lowest to the highest, and that each person acts continuously to satisfy these needs. Maslow explained that until a lower-order need was satisfied, the individual couldn't think or turn his mind to a higher-order need. He also demonstrated that once a need has been satisfied, it's no longer a motivator. Once you get something you want and you have enough of it, you're no longer motivated or driven to get it. Your motivation then changes toward getting something that you still feel a need for. Let me explain. Maslow's hierarchy originally had 5 needs or levels. In his later research, he suggested that there were 2 even higher needs. The lowest need, and the first need that must be satisfied, is the need for survival. Until a person's survival needs are satisfied, until he or she is no longer concerned for the basics of life, food, clothing, shelter, that person is not concerned about higher needs. Maslow also demonstrated that a person who, through accident or circumstance, was deprived of a lower need, like food, he would stop trying to fulfill any higher need until the lower need was satisfied once more. The second need up on Maslow's hierarchy is the need for security of all kinds, physical, emotional, financial, and so on. This is the foundation of the life insurance industry. Once a person is assured of survival, he or she becomes concerned with security. Once the need for security has been met, the individual then turns to the third level of need, which is the need for love and belonging, the need to be accepted by other human beings. People need to interact and associate with other people, to feel themselves to be part of a social group, to be known and cared for by others. This is why solitary confinement is the worst punishment that can be given to the worst criminal in the worst maximum security institution. Being deprived of the company of others is very painful emotionally. The fourth level of need discussed by Maslow is the need for self-esteem. This is the need to like yourself and respect yourself and feel that you're respected and appreciated by others. The fifth level of need on Maslow's hierarchy is the need for self-actualization. This is defined as the feeling that you are becoming everything you're capable of becoming. Maslow felt that the most advanced and fully mature members of our society were those who were functioning at the higher levels of need satisfaction. Self-actualization can be seen when people engage in activities that challenge their abilities and stretch them toward the greater realizations of their full potential. The 2 higher needs that Maslow added later were the need for beauty and the need for truth, in that order. Once a person has satisfied his or her needs for survival, security, belonging, self-esteem, and self-actualization, he or she would naturally turn to beauty, as in music or art, and truth, as in philosophy or religion. However, if a person who is functioning at the higher levels of the hierarchy of needs suddenly fell off a moving boat in the middle of the night and was threatened with drowning, he or she would immediately forget about the satisfaction of all higher needs and would revert instantly to a total concern with survival, the most basic of human needs. As you mature and grow and become a more fully functioning human being, you find that you're motivated at a higher and higher level of need. The kinds of dissatisfactions that you experience, which deprive you of the happiness that you desire, are triggered by dissatisfaction at higher and higher levels. One of the wonderful things about Western society is that, because of our relative level of affluence, more and more people have been freed from a preoccupation with satisfying lower-level needs and given the opportunity to devote more of their time and thoughts to the satisfaction of higher-level needs. The lower-level needs, those of survival and security and belonging, are all what might be called deficiency needs. The fulfilling of these needs doesn't necessarily make you happy, but being deprived of these needs can make you very unhappy indeed. The higher level needs, the needs for self-esteem, for self-actualization, for beauty and truth, are all what are called being needs. These are needs the fulfillment of which can make you happier and happier and can lead you to the feelings of elation, joy, and peak experiences where you feel absolutely wonderful about yourself and life in every respect. This, of course, is one of the highest states of happiness. In achieving your own happiness, another helpful way of defining what happiness means to you is something that I teach in my seminars. I say that everything that you could possibly want in life could be listed under 1 of 7 categories. You always have a tendency to measure how well you're doing in life and how happy you are by how much of each of these seven ingredients you have or have not managed to achieve. The first overall ingredient of happiness is peace of mind. You are happy to the degree to which you can achieve your own peace of mind. The interesting thing about inner peace is that it's the normal, natural state of man, and that it is deviations from inner peace and happiness that are unnatural and abnormal. It's important to point this out because many people think that the experience of inner joy is unusual and accidental. Others, very few, realize that this inner experience is the norm, and they strive to organize their lives so that they have it more often. The second ingredient of happiness is health and energy. Your health, which is largely reflected in your levels of energy, is the absolute minimum requirement for the assurance of your survival and well-being. You know that if you gain everything else but you lose your health, you're failing in the most important area. But if you achieve and maintain high levels of health and energy, no matter what else happens to you on the outside, you're still doing pretty well as a human being. The third ingredient of happiness is loving relationships. You are happy and successful to the degree that other people love and respect you, and you love and respect other people. Most of your happiness in life will come from your interactions with those people that you care about and who care about you. So developing and preserving loving relationships with other people is a measure of everything you are as a human being. The fourth ingredient of happiness is financial freedom. Most people want a lot of money primarily because they feel that with a lot of money, they'll be free to live their lives the way they want. And they feel that this will make them happy. Most material objects and accomplishments are seen as a means to achieve this end. The big mistake that many people make is that they confuse means and ends, and they become totally obsessed with getting and spending, and they lose sight of the reasons for wanting money in the first place. Financial freedom can be defined simply as having enough money so that you don't worry about it or think about it, so that you can then turn your mind and emotions to other, more important subjects. Money is a little bit like a deficiency need in that if you have enough of it, you seldom think about it. But if you have too little for any period of time, you think of almost nothing else. The fifth ingredient of happiness is worthy goals and ideals. In reality, happiness is a condition that you experience when you're fully engaged in doing something that is important and meaningful to you. This is why Viktor Frankl wrote that a need for meaning and purpose is the deepest craving in human nature. It's only when you feel that your life stands for something bigger than yourself and that what you're doing is making a difference in the world that you're truly happy. The sixth ingredient of happiness is self-knowledge and self-understanding. The ancient Greeks had a saying engraved in stone above the temple of Apollo at Delphi, which said, "Man, know thyself." This advice is more than 2,000 years old, and it's equally true today. You can only be happy when you fully understand why it is you feel the way you feel and do the things you do. Self-knowledge and self-understanding seem to go hand in hand with inner peace, tranquility, and happiness. The seventh overall ingredient of happiness is a sense of self-fulfillment. It's the feeling you have when you're living your life completely and leaving nothing out. Henry David Thoreau, when he withdrew to Walden Pond for 2 years to think about life, wrote that his primary motivation was to live deliberately and not to come to the end of my years without ever having really lived. Self-fulfillment is another word for self-actualization. This is the need being satisfied by those men and women who have the healthiest personalities and who are the most fully integrated members of our society. Now, you have to ask yourself, in which of these areas might you be suffering a deficiency? In which of these areas are you currently dissatisfied or unhappy for any reason? Here's a helpful exercise that you can give to yourself on a regular basis. Take a clean sheet of paper and, giving yourself only 30 seconds to reply, ask yourself this question. What are my three most important goals in life right now? Write down the answers quickly without thought or evaluation. Then, ask yourself the second question. what are my three biggest worries or problems in life right now? And write them down quickly as well. The answers to these questions will reveal two remarkable things. First, they'll indicate to you clearly what you need to do more of or have more of in order to be happy. And second, they'll show you what you need to eliminate in order to get rid of any unhappiness or dissatisfaction that currently exists in your life. Your subconscious mind is remarkable in this way. If you only give yourself 30 seconds to write down the answers to these questions, your subconscious will sort through all the millions of bits of data stored in your mental computer and pop the correct answers to the surface of your mind and onto the piece of paper as accurately as if you had taken 30 minutes or even 3 hours to perform the same exercise. Try it for yourself and see. Now, in addition to the laws of success and achievement we discussed earlier, there are 8 specific laws you can practice to achieve the happiness you both desire and deserve. The first law is the law of integrity. This law says that happiness arises as a byproduct of your choosing to live your life consistent with your highest values and aspirations. Just as Maslow's highest need is truth, your highest need and the foundation of your happiness is living in truth with yourself and with everything and everyone around you. The slightest deviation from truth, the slightest tendency to compromise with what you know to be right, will detract from your happiness almost immediately. You are designed with an inner guide or conscience that always tells you the right thing to do, and you're only happy when you live your life completely consistent with it. To be happy, your goals and your values must be congruent. They must fit into each other like a hand into a glove. Virtually all stress and unhappiness comes from trying to do one thing when you believe something else is more important and more correct. For example, most people believe that their relationships, their spouses, their children, their families are more important to them than anything else. However, they sometimes become confused and begin to spend an inordinate amount of time achieving material success in their careers, thereby ignoring their relationships. And the harder they work at their jobs, the more dissatisfied and unhappy they become, even when they're financially successful, because deep down inside they know that what is truly valuable to them is the people in their lives, not the money. It's only when you have the courage to insist upon living your life in complete harmony with your highest values that happiness arises and emerges spontaneously, like sunrise, bringing you the peace and contentment you really want. The first part of the law of integrity says that when you set goals and ideals that are worthy of you and strive to achieve them, you'll experience happiness and satisfaction. As Shakespeare said in the play Hamlet, "To thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man." The second part of the law of integrity says that whenever you choose to live consistent with the very best that is in you, you'll automatically experience happiness and joy. You've probably had an experience in life where you've decided to walk away from a bad situation, even though it might have been costly either emotionally or financially, but you did it because it was the right thing to do. You acted on a higher principle. You behaved in a manner consistent with your highest values. You'll also recall that having decided to do so and having done it, you felt absolutely wonderful about yourself and your life. You felt a tremendous experience of elation and joy. And the most remarkable thing was that everything turned out all right in the end. All of the negative consequences that you were afraid might occur never materialized. Perhaps the finest example of living in truth and the most important demonstration of your integrity or honesty is with regard to peace of mind. It's only when you set peace of mind as your highest goal and you refuse to stay in any situation that detracts from your peace of mind that you'll find yourself enjoying the highest and finest form of happiness. The law of integrity is another way of saying that you are given peace of mind to serve you as an inner barometer. It'll tell you what is right for you and what is wrong. If you listen to your intuition and only do and say what gives you a sense of inner peace and harmony, you'll probably never make another mistake. In fact, Catherine Ponder writes in her book, the dynamic laws of prosperity, that men and women begin to become great only when they begin to take time by themselves to listen to their inner voices and organize their lives in such a way that their activities and relationships give them a deep sense of inner peace. The first step that you can take to personal greatness is to sit down quietly and look over your life to determine the areas where you're not experiencing the peace of mind and happiness that you really want. You'll find that this is a very easy exercise to do because your mind is continually preoccupied with these problems, just like a person sitting on a tack would be preoccupied with the pain. Your job is to get off the tack. Your responsibility to yourself is to realize that you can never make someone else happy by being unhappy yourself, just as you can never make someone else healthy by being sick. You should not sacrifice your happiness in an attempt to somehow achieve the happiness of another person. You'll only end up making no one happy, especially yourself. In the play Cyrano de Bergerac by Edmond Rostand, Cyrano, the great individualist, is asked why it is that he is so outspoken and so self-assertive. He answers with this beautiful line. He says, "I choose the line of least resistance in this, that I will please at least myself in all things." When you make the decision that, for better or worse, you will please at least yourself in all things, only then will you be truly happy. And only then, it seems, will you be able to help anyone else to be happy as well. The second law of happiness is the law of emotion. It says that human beings are 100% emotional in everything they think and feel and decide. I used to think that people were 90% emotional and 10% logical. However, both research and experience contradicts this conclusion. People are totally emotional in everything they do. If a person says to you that he's decided to do the logical thing, it simply means that he has more emotion devoted to that course of action than he does to another course of action, and he uses the word logical to justify his decision. Someone once said that no matter how old you become, you always have the emotions of a teenager. This may or may not be true, but the central impact of your emotions and feelings is a key component in both understanding and achieving your own happiness. The first part of the law of emotion is that you are motivated by two major groups of emotions: those of love or desire, and those of fear or loss. These are the positive emotions and the negative emotions. These emotions were described by Sigmund Freud as emotions associated with pleasure and emotions associated with pain. You have a tendency to move toward those experiences you associate with pleasure or happiness, and you have a tendency to move away from those experiences you associate with pain or unhappiness. This is the essence of the pleasure principle that I mentioned earlier. The second part of this law of emotion says that the content of your emotional life is largely determined by the thoughts you dwell upon most of the time. This is such a simple and obvious truth that it's often overlooked by most people. It simply says that if you think happy thoughts, you will be a happy person. If you think angry thoughts, you'll be an angry person. If you think about the things that people have done to hurt you and the reasons you have to be angry or unhappy, you'll be negative, pessimistic, and eventually you'll be depressed. Abraham Lincoln once wrote, "A man is just about as happy as he makes up his mind to be." Well, this is true for you and true for me. The third part of the law of emotion says, if you deliberately choose to think positive, loving, uplifting thoughts, you can create and maintain your own happiness in spite of what is happening around you. No one can make you feel anything. As Eleanor Roosevelt said, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent. You decide to feel happy, and you decide to feel unhappy by the thoughts that you choose to dwell upon most of the time. Therefore, the smartest thing for you or anyone else to do is to choose to dwell upon the kind of thoughts that uplift and enrich your life. The third law in this session is the basic law of happiness, which says the quality of your life is largely determined by how you feel at any given moment. Because you're 100% emotional in every respect, it is how you feel that determines your levels of energy, your personality, your attitude, your levels of performance and output, the clarity of your thinking, the quality of your relationships, and your level of happiness. Truly successful people are those who enjoy every part of the journey at least as much, if not more so, than they anticipate enjoying the destination. Earl Nightingale once wrote that happiness is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. Happiness comes from working step by step toward the accomplishment of something that's important to you. It's the process more than the end result that constitutes happiness, because happiness is experienced in the now rather than at some future date. The first part of this law of happiness is that how you feel, the quality of your emotional life, is largely determined by how you talk to yourself. Your self-talk, your inner dialogue, what you say to yourself on a regular basis, largely determines the tone of your emotional life. And the wonderful thing about your self-talk is that it's completely under your own control. One of the best bits of advice I ever read was, when something goes wrong, say something right. Immediately override a negative experience by saying something positive and cheerful. Control your own self-talk. This brings us to the second part of the law of happiness, which says that the way you interpret events to yourself determines your emotional responses to those events. This is another way of saying that it's not what happens to you, but how you react to what happens to you that determines how you feel about it. If you interpret an external event as being positive or helpful, you'll remain optimistic and cheerful. If you interpret the same event as being negative or hurtful, you'll become angry and frustrated. You'll make yourself unhappy. And the choice is always yours. The third part of this law says that the fastest way to take control of your emotions is to look for the good in any situation you're facing. Now, this requires tremendous strength of will, especially when things are going wrong all around you and people are blaming you for their problems. However, if you look for the good, even if you just seek out the valuable lesson in each experience, you'll always find it. And you can't be looking for the good or the valuable lessons that the experience holds for you and be negative or unhappy at the same time. Remember, your subconscious mind can only hold one thought at a time, either positive or negative. And if you deliberately choose to hold positive thoughts and dwell upon those thoughts, then the negative thoughts simply can't get in. This brings us naturally to the fourth law of happiness, which is called the law of substitution. It says that you can keep yourself positive by substituting a positive thought for a negative thought. The law of substitution is often called the crowding out principle. It simply says that you can crowd out of your mind any thoughts that aren't helpful to you by simply choosing to focus your attention on a thought that is more helpful or more positive. Many people are negative for the simple reason that they have not deliberately chosen to be positive. They have not systematically planted in their minds the thoughts that are consistent with the emotions they desire to experience. Dr. Martin Seligman of the University of Pennsylvania, in his recent book, Learned Optimism, talks about his 25 years of research in cognitive psychology. He says that the great majority of people, the pessimists, have developed what he calls learned helplessness. He says that if a person has a series of experiences or makes a series of attempts to do something and is not successful, that person unconsciously assumes that there's nothing that he can do to change things. He perceives himself to be helpless. From that point onward, even when he's given an opportunity of some kind, he will turn it down and give you every conceivable reason why it's not possible for him. He's tried and failed in the past, and so he's now learned to be helpless. An illustration of this is the Indian elephant, a huge beast that weighs as much as 5 tons. Indian elephants are domesticated very early in life and trained to be docile and easily controlled by their owners. The way they do it is simple. When the elephant is a baby, its owner chains it with a large chain to a large stake driven deeply into the ground. The elephant struggles against the chain for hour after hour. Finally, the baby elephant gives up and accepts that when it's chained to a stake, it's helpless. It does no good to struggle. It might just as well stand there until its master comes back and takes off the chain. For the rest of the elephant's life, all its owner has to do is to tie a small rope around the elephant's leg and attach the rope to a small stake in the ground in order to hold the elephant firmly. The elephant, as soon as it feels the rope and the stake, stops struggling. Even though the rope is small and the stake is shallow, the elephant has learned to be helpless. The elephant no longer struggles or strains against the leash. The elephant may have the strength and the power to knock down houses, but it's completely docile and easily controlled because of its attitude. The elephant's earlier experiences of futility have convinced it that it's powerless whenever it's tied to a stake, no matter how small the stake may be. Now, many people are like that elephant because they allow themselves to think continually of the reasons why not, rather than the reasons why. It seems that as soon as you begin to concentrate on how you can achieve a goal, rather than whether or not it's achievable, your mind automatically becomes positive and all your energies become channeled toward achievement and happiness rather than toward failure and frustration. The fifth law of happiness is the law of expression, which states that whatever is expressed is impressed, and whatever is impressed is expressed. Whatever you say, either to yourself or out loud, is impressed into your subconscious mind, and whatever is impressed into your subconscious mind will ultimately be expressed in your thoughts, your feelings, your conversation, and your actions. The more emotion that you use to express any thought or idea, the more deeply it will be impressed into your subconscious mind, and the more rapidly it will be re-expressed in your life. Whatever you say with conviction triggers thoughts, ideas, and actions consistent with those words, so be sure to pick your words carefully. When you think of a challenge or a goal, and you repeat to yourself the words, "I can do it, I can do it, I can do it," you trigger all kinds of feelings and actions that propel you forward toward doing the things that will enable you to achieve the goal. The sixth law of happiness is the law of reversibility. It states that just as your feelings determine your actions also determine your feelings. This is a remarkable and powerful law that says that even if you don't feel a particular way, such as self-confident or happy, if you act as if or pretend that you have the feelings already, the actions themselves will have a backflow effect and generate the emotions consistent with them. When you act in a certain way, the actions themselves trigger thoughts, images, feelings, and attitudes that are consistent with those actions. You can, in effect, control much of the content of your mental and emotional life simply by moving your body in such a way that it's consistent with the way in which you wish to think and feel. The seventh law of happiness is the law of visualization, which states that ideas and images tend to awaken emotions and feelings that correspond to them. When you create clear mental pictures of yourself as happy, positive, and optimistic, these mental pictures will trigger feelings and actions that actually lead to your being happy, positive, and optimistic. One of the most helpful exercises that you can engage in is to think of a time in your life when you've been extremely happy, and to replay that experience on the screen of your mind, as though you were running a movie projector. Put yourself right into the picture and re-experience or get the feelings that go with it. You can actually make yourself happy by dwelling upon previous experiences when you've been happy. The eighth law of happiness is the law of practice. This law states that whatever you practice and repeat often enough becomes a new habit. Just as you learn to drive a car or type on a typewriter or ride a bicycle, you can train yourself to be a predominantly happy and optimistic person by walking, talking, and acting as though you were happy already. You begin to become happy when you decide for yourself the combination of ingredients in your life that will make you happy and then start to move toward them. Simultaneously, you need to determine the things in your life that are depriving you of happiness and begin to remove them. Happiness is an active state or condition that you experience when you're becoming everything that you're capable of becoming and you're moving toward the realization of your full potential. It's only when you're doing something that's important to you, something that causes you to strive and stretch toward your limits, that you experience joy and satisfaction. Underlying it all is the law of correspondence, which says that you will be happy on the outside to the degree to which you are happy on the inside. The more true you are to yourself and the more consistently you live in harmony with your highest values and aspirations, the happier a person you will be. Your ability to enter into and maintain long-term, intimate, loving relationships with other people, and especially with one other person, tells how fully developed you really are. In the last session, I talked about Abraham Maslow, who spent many years studying the most happy and successful men and women in our society. He found that one of the qualities of these self-actualizing people was that they were able to enter into and build strong relationships that endured for many years, often a lifetime. Now, everything that you've become as a human being and as an individual personality is captured in the quality of your interactions with other people. Fully 85% of the happiness you enjoy in life will come from your relationships with others. Unfortunately, this also means that fully 85% of your unhappiness and frustration will come from problems that you have with other people, especially the people who are closest to you. It's therefore in your best interest to learn everything you possibly can about forming and enjoying loving relationships with other people. There are a variety of different kinds of loves. Much of what we have learned about love is both partially true and partially false, and it's usually somewhat confusing. Sometimes the concept of love gets bundled up with romantic love or self-love or love of mankind, love of animals or nature or beauty or truth or something else. For each person, the scope and quality of the love he or she needs and requires to be fully happy and fulfilled is different. Just as plants strive upward toward the light of the sun, you as a human being strive continually toward the major sources of love in your life. It's been said that everything we do is either to get love or to compensate for the lack of love. Virtually all personality problems can be traced back to love withheld in early childhood. Most adults spend the second 50 years of their life getting over the experiences of the first 5 years, most of which were associated with inappropriate mixtures of love and punishment and criticism and negativity. We know that the adult personality is healthy to the degree to which the child received a high quality and quantity of love during the first 3 to 5 years of his or her life. If, for any reason, there was a breakdown of love at this time, the adult will manifest these shortages and deficiencies in his or her relationships with other members of the opposite sex when they grow up. Dr. Morris Massey says that as adults, we seek for what we most felt we were deprived of as children. We're internally driven below our subconscious levels to attempt to fill a void or gap that arose in us in early childhood and which we were almost completely unaware of. As adults, in all of our love relationships, we're oriented toward completion and fulfillment of some kind, toward satisfying deep unconscious needs that arose during our formative years. The brilliant Harvard psychologist and sociologist, Peterim Sorokin, studied the phenomenon of love extensively and wrote about it in his book, The Ways and Powers of Love. In this marvelous work, one of the most complete treatments of the subject of love ever written, Sorokin describes every form of love and the different qualities that are manifested in the practice of love. For example, he talks about the breadth of love, how many people a person can love at one time. He refers to the intensity of love, or how deeply one can feel about another individual. He talks about the duration of love, the specificity of love, the variability of love, the stability or enduring power of love, and several other aspects of the subject. What he makes clear is that love is not a simple thing at all. And because it's so important, it's well worth our while to learn as much about it as we can. Sometimes, just a little knowledge of the subject of love can have a wonderfully positive effect on our relationships with others and can give us the tools that we need to be more happy with other people. Dr. Edmund Opitz, a teacher of mine many years ago, once observed that you can take almost anything to excess except love. He said that love is the one thing in the world that there can never be too much of. I never forgot those words, and over the years I've found that they are as true as anything can be. Perhaps the most wonderful thing about love is that the more you have of it for others, the more of it you have for yourself. The more often that you tell another person that you love him or her, the more love you have for yourself. Love only grows by sharing. The more of it you give away, the more of it you have. And the converse is unfortunately true. The less of it you give away, the less of it you have for yourself, which goes to explain a lot of unhappiness. Many parents would agree that one of the great benefits and blessings of having children is they teach us more about unselfish, unconditional love than we could ever learn without them. Children in their formative years are like sponges for love. They can absorb love like the desert sand can absorb water. They need love like roses need rain. They can take all the love you have to give them and more besides. Fortunately, we as human beings are designed not only to seek love and to receive love, but to give love to others. And there's no time that we feel more fully alive and more fully human than when we are pouring out our love to another person. This is why children can enrich their parents out of all proportion to the time and money and effort they spend in raising them to adulthood. In this session, however, I want to talk specifically about the love between men and women and how it can be improved and enhanced. There are 11 laws that explain much of what happens between two people, and a knowledge of these laws can help you to be more effective in your most important relationship. The first law of love and relationships is the law of commitment. This law says that the level of commitment is the critical element that determines the long-term health and happiness of a relationship. In study after study, men and women who were found to be the happiest with each other over long periods of time were those who were totally committed to each other and to their relationship. They never considered or discussed the possibility of the relationship not working out. It never entered their minds whether this relationship would last. It was an accepted fact, without question or comment. The relationship was there to stay. One of the great difficulties in relationships is what is called the go-halfway mentality. This mentality arises when one or both parties are not willing to make a total 100% commitment to the relationship. One or both of them is hedging their bets, and they're playing it safe. This lack of commitment triggers deep-seated fears of rejection and non-acceptance and leads to a tremendous amount of unhappiness and tension in the relationship. One of the external manifestations of this failure to make a total commitment is the habit of dividing expenses or keeping separate bank accounts. Sometimes people take turns buying things for the house or apartment and keep a careful list of who bought what. I know a couple who lived together for 11 years but never got around to getting married. He bought the pots and pans, she bought the dishes. He bought the couch, she bought the chairs. He bought the stereo, she bought the television. On every single item, there was a little sticker with the initials of the person who had paid for it. At the end of 11 years, they had a quarrel and decided to go their separate ways. They were able to divide up their accumulated possessions in less than 2 hours, to go off in different directions and never see or have anything to do with each other again. Because of the lack of commitment that entered into the beginning of the relationship, manifested in a continual division of property, they were mentally preparing to go their separate ways from very early on. Another example of this lack of commitment is the prenuptial agreement. two parties draw up an agreement that in effect specifies how the property will be divided when the relationship collapses. The desire for or the insistence upon a prenuptial agreement usually means that one or both parties don't place very much faith in the long-term strength of the marriage. The second law of love and relationships is the law of value. It says that love is a response to value. You always love in another what you most admire and respect in a human being. This means that love is not blind. You tend to be attracted to a person who you think has qualities that you feel are ideal in another person. The first part of the law of value says that when you love and respect a quality or virtue, you tend to love and respect another person who appears to have it. This facet of love can apply to your feelings toward any other human being, male or female, young or old. We all have an unconscious tendency to give our love and commitment to those people who we feel are most representative of what we value most in others. Part two of this law says that in a love relationship, you tend to love and be more compatible with another who possesses qualities you admire and which are complementary to your own. Like everyone, you're composed of strengths and weaknesses. Most people have more weaknesses than they have strengths. And since you live with yourself all the time, you're painfully aware of the deficiencies that you might have in your own character and personality. You also have an innate urge for completion and wholeness, so you tend to seek out a member of the opposite sex who has strengths where you have weaknesses. Part three of this law says that men and women seek balance and completeness by finding another who appears to be a complement of themselves. One of the things we know is that when two people are ideal for each other, their personalities balance each other. When blended together, these two people actually form a single, complete person. He is gregarious and outgoing. She is quiet and reserved. He's casual and less concerned with facts and details. She is fastidious and attentive. She is a great implementer, while he is a great planner. He gets upset at silly things, while she remains calm and stable in the midst of chaos. These two people balance each other and combine to make an ideal couple. The third law of relationships is the law of compatibility, which says people are more compatible together when they are most similar in beliefs, attitudes, values, and ambitions. Compatibility is one of the most important of all factors in determining the long-term health and happiness of two people in a relationship. Long-term happiness depends upon a high degree of harmony and peace, which is only possible if the essential parts of life are largely resolved and beyond argument. For example, the number one cause of marital breakdown in America today is disagreements over money. If two people have two different attitudes toward earning, spending, and saving money, it'll lead to continuous clashes. It's only when two people have the same attitudes toward money that it doesn't become a source of argument or disagreement. The same principle applies to children. It's essential for long-term compatibility that both people have very much the same attitudes toward children, both in having them and bringing them up. Another area where couples need to be compatible is in the way they spend their leisure time. If he likes the beach and she likes the mountains, or he likes to stay home and she likes to go out, and they can't find ways to compromise, they'll be clashing constantly. Many people are initially drawn together because of mutual attraction, but it's the compatibility or lack of compatibility with regard to the key values and activities of day-to-day life that will determine the long-term love and strength of the relationship. Sometimes couples grow apart and become incompatible. In my seminars, I point out that this is a major cause of stress, anxiety, unhappiness, and even psychosomatic illness. When incompatibility sets in, the very first thing that stops is the laughter between the two people. Soon after that, the conversation dwindles away. If they have children, they'll find that they have very little else to talk about except the children, and beyond that, they really have nothing to say to each other. They have become incompatible. The very best thing to do if you find that you're growing apart is to make every effort to build a new bridge of compatibility. go for a long drive, take a trip, even a long vacation together, and do everything possible to develop new areas of interest and understanding. There are also excellent weekend seminars which couples can attend to rebuild and reaffirm their relationships. There are books that you can read, and there's counseling that you can seek out. However, if the incompatibility cannot be overcome, and you find that you're no longer happy with the other person, you no longer have anything in common, then you have to make some hard decisions. One of the things that holds people back from dissolving a marriage that's no longer working is because very often they're overly concerned about what they think other people might say or think, especially other members of their families. My experience, however, in dealing with thousands of men and women has brought me to this simple conclusion. No matter what people say or what you may think they may say, the truth of the matter is that other people really don't think about you very much at all. It isn't so much that people don't care. It's just that they have so many problems of their own, so many unresolved conflicts and difficulties with the people in their lives, that they only have a very small portion of their emotional energies to devote to you and to your life. The bottom line is this. Never stay in an unhappy relationship because of what you think others might say. With regard to yourself and another person, always make your decisions based on what will make you happy, both in the short term and in the long term. As long as you use your own happiness as your guide for behavior and decision making, you will be as right as you possibly can be in any situation involving someone else. The fourth law of relationships is the law of communication. This law states that the essence of a happy relationship is good communication, but that there are differences in the way men and women communicate. In order to communicate well, it's essential that both parties are aware of the differences in communication styles and the differences in both meaning and intention that these styles display. The first part of this law is that men are direct, women are indirect. Now, there are always exceptions to any rules that we attempt to apply to human beings, but this one is generally true. Men tend to be direct, straightforward, and to the point. Women, on the other hand, tend to be indirect, roundabout, and more subtle. Men tend to resolve differences of opinion by speaking louder and faster, while women attempt to resolve disagreements by finding common ground and approaching the situation with greater sensitivity. The second part of the law of communication says simply that never assume that you understand what the other is thinking and feeling. If you have any doubt at all, you are probably completely wrong about what's going on. The only way to assure a high quality of communication between two people is to, first of all, seek to understand the other person before you try to get the other person to understand you. The more you concentrate on understanding, the better will be the quality of your communication, and the stronger will be your relationship. The fifth law of relationships is the law of attention. This law says that you always pay attention to what you most love and value. You're always attracted to the kind of person that you find most valuable and worthwhile. As your attention goes, so goes your life. Life is merely the study of attention. What attracts your attention in all areas is a very good indication of who you are and what is of the greatest interest to you. Your attention and what holds it can often lead you to the right career, the right people, and the right relationship. The first part of the law of attention says, you tend to ignore what you don't value. You do not pay attention to things that you place little value on. If you don't value something at all, you'll hardly even notice it. It won't attract you and keep you interested. Of course, what we mean here is that if you ignore another person, or even if you seem to ignore another person, you send a message to that other person that you don't consider him or her to be of value. Since we often make the mistake of inadvertently ignoring the people we most love, we need to be aware that this attitude on our part, even accidentally, can hurt other people's feelings and lead to problems in our relationships. Part two of the law of attention says that sincere, attentive listening to another is the highest form of love and sensitivity. Patient, uninterrupted listening is one of the highest forms of flattery. It's the way that you tell the other person that you really consider him or her to be important and to be of value to you. The third part of the law of attention is that listening builds trust, which is the foundation of all lasting relationships. Listening is the essence of excellent communications, and it's the one activity that builds the trust that assures the long-term strength and well-being of the relationship between two people. Whenever you listen to another person, you tell that person in no uncertain terms how much you value him or her and how important what he or she is thinking or saying is to you. The sixth law of love and relationships is the law of self-esteem. It's similar to the principle of love in that self-esteem refers to self-love. The law says that everything you do in life is to either increase or protect your self-esteem and sense of personal value and worth. How much you like and value yourself, how much you accept yourself as a worthwhile and important human being, goes to the very core of your personality. You are always most attracted to people and situations that build and reinforce your sense of personal value. Simultaneously, you tend to be repelled by people and situations that threaten or harm your self-esteem. Part one of this law says that you will tend to be happiest with a person who makes you feel good about yourself. In this sense, love is perfectly selfish. You pick out another person to love because when you're with that person, you feel the best about yourself. You feel happy. In fact, it's very common for people to say that when they've met the right person, that they have met their best friend. There's nobody that they enjoy being with and talking to and going places with more than that person. The second part of the law of self-esteem says that everything you do to raise the self-esteem of another causes your own self-esteem to go up and makes you like yourself more. One of the wonderful things about doing kindnesses for another person is that everything that you do which makes someone else feel better about themselves causes you to feel better about yourself. This is an example of the law of correspondence in action. Your outer world tends to be a reflection of your inner world. Your external life tends to be a mirror image of your internal life. Everything you do to make other people feel better about themselves reflects back on you and makes you feel better about yourself. The third part of the law of self-esteem could be called Carnegie's Corollary from Dale Carnegie, who first wrote it in his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. He wrote that you can make more friends in a couple of days by becoming genuinely interested in others than you could in a year trying to get others interested in you. This is one of the keys to truly successful relationships. The seventh law of love and relationships is the law of indirect effort. It says that you get almost everything in your relationships with others more indirectly than directly. This is true between men and women, between parents and children, between bosses and employees, and between salespeople and customers. The more you approach your relationships indirectly, the more likely you are to be successful. One of the reasons why women are rising to the top of many fields today is because they know and practice this law intuitively in their interactions with others. For example, the first illustration of this law says that the more you appreciate and thank others, the more appreciative they will be of you. It says that if you want people to appreciate you, you should appreciate them first. If you want people to do large things for you, you should thank them profusely when they do small things for you. When you develop an attitude of gratitude and appear genuinely thankful to everyone for everything they do, you'll be astonished at how warm and helpful and friendly they'll be in the future. Another illustration or example of the law of indirect effort is that the fastest way to impress another person is to be impressed by him or her. The direct way of impressing another is to try to overwhelm that person with stories and examples of what an amazing person you are. The indirect way to impress another, however, is to be impressed by the other person first. The more impressed you are with another, the more impressed he or she will be with you and your judgment. A further example of the law of indirect effort says that if you want to gain the approval and respect of others, the surest way is to give them your approval and respect in advance. Most men and women who are successful with members of the opposite sex have found that it's very easy to cause another person to be fascinated with you if you simply become very interested in and fascinated with the other person in advance. You tend to set up a force field of human magnetism that draws people to you like moths are drawn to a candle. A man or woman with no extraordinary accomplishments can be very effective in dealing with people in a social situation simply by asking questions, listening intently, and being sincerely appreciative of the other person. The eighth law is the law of reverse effort, which says that the harder you don't try in a relationship, the easier it tends to be. You are most effective in your relationships with others when you rise above the urge to try harder to make the relationship better. The more relaxed and accepting you are of the relationship, the smoother and easier it is for both of you. The second comment on the law of reverse effort is very important. It says, every relationship has its own timing. If you try to hurry it up or slow it down, you merely create resistance and often a crisis. When two people meet, either the timing is right or it's not. At every stage of a relationship, there's a correct time for every major decision, and timing is everything. Research shows that you reach a natural stage in your thinking when you're ready to settle down with one person. Whoever you meet at that point in your life will, assuming compatibility, be the person that you will marry. At the same time, if you're going through a turbulent period in your inner life, you'll tend to find yourself in a turbulent relationship. You'll tend to attract the kind of person that mirrors your internal psychological state. The most important part of the concept of timing is that you can't speed things up or slow them down when they involve another person. Often, people will meet, go out on a date, and find that they have nothing in common. 5 years later, they'll meet again, fall in love, get married, and live happily for the rest of their lives. It's all a matter of timing. The third comment on the law of reverse effort simply says that sometimes the very best thing to do in a difficult situation with another person is the opposite of your natural tendency. If you feel like being angry and impatient, sometimes the very best thing to do is to be kind and understanding. If you feel like trying harder, sometimes the very best thing to do is to relax and let things unfold naturally. If you feel like speaking up and counterattacking in an argument, sometimes the very best thing to do is to remain silent and listen patiently until the other person has vented his or her frustrations. The eighth law is the law of control as it applies to relationships. In this case, it says, you are happy in a relationship to the degree to which you feel that you have a sense of control over what is happening. This is one of the most important single principles of happiness and mental well-being. You need to feel that your primary relationship is largely self-determined and is something that you can change and affect. If you feel that you have too much control or too little control in a relationship, both conditions will lead to problems and unhappiness for both parties. Part one of the law of control in relationships says that you can increase your sense of control by asserting yourself and taking deliberate action to direct or change the relationship. And sometimes when you feel out of control in a relationship, the very best thing for you to do is to step up, put both your hands on the wheel of the relationship, and take firm, positive action to change things in such a way that they are more satisfactory to you. Make a decision. Get on or get off. Your very act of decisiveness and your willingness to take action can often resolve a difficulty with another person. Part two of this law of control, however, says that you can often assert control in a relationship only by walking away. In fact, it's only when you're willing to walk away from a relationship that you're in a position to change it, if change is possible. You must often be willing to end a relationship, to break it up and to put it back together on a new basis, if you're going to be able to change it or improve it at all. Either asserting yourself in a relationship or walking away from the relationship can be the solution to the difficulties that you might be experiencing. Be prepared to try either one in every situation. The ninth law of love and relationships is the law of identification. It says that you are dominated by everything and everyone with which you become identified. Everything you take personally and identify with emotionally, everything that you become attached to, tends to blur your emotional vision and cause you to be controlled and dominated by it, especially people and relationships. The first comment on the law of identification says that you can dominate, direct, and control things only to the degree to which you can disidentify yourself from them. This means that it's only to the degree to which you can stand back and be objective about your relationship that you can see it clearly and that you can act effectively within it. This is true in virtually every situation in life. That's why they say that a person who acts as his own lawyer has a fool for a client. The second comment on the law of identification says that attachment and identification cause you to lose perspective and control over your emotions. The more involved you become, the less capable you are of acting in your best interests. And this brings us to the third comment on this law, which is the basis of mental maturity and emotional stability. It says, detachment and disidentification are the keys to peace of mind and happy relationships. They're the keys to self-actualization and personal happiness. You have to be able to put your relationship at arm's length and evaluate it honestly and objectively in order to enjoy it to the fullest. You'll often have situations where the other person will become very emotional about a particular issue. If you're not careful, you'll also get caught up in it, becoming very emotional yourself. The best thing, however, for you to do is to exert a certain degree of self-mastery and keep yourself unemotional while the other person is expressing his or her feelings. In this way, you can be of the greatest help to the other person, and you can see things more clearly. You can remain more calm and detached. You can assure a greater level of happiness for both of you. The 10th law of love and relationships is one of the most important of all. It is the law of forgiveness. It says, you are mentally healthy and mature to the degree to which you can freely forgive those who you feel have hurt you in some way. This is another way of saying that the quality of forgiveness is the highest of all human qualities, and it's the key to both spiritual development and peace of mind. As human beings, we are intensely egotistical and sensitive about ourselves and the way we're treated by others. Whenever we feel that someone has transgressed against us or has hurt us in any way or taken advantage of us, we become very angry and resentful. And we tend to hold on to this anger and resentment far too long, thereby making ourselves negative and pessimistic and ineffective in our relationships with other people. The solution is for us to freely forgive everyone whom we feel has ever done anything to hurt us in any way. Accept full responsibility for your contribution to the situation. Remember, whatever it was, you probably got yourself into it through your own conduct and your own behavior, through your own thinking and your own decisions. Therefore, you're at least partially responsible. However, the mark of the superior person is that he or she accepts the burden of responsibility and simply lets the negativity go. So forgive others freely and then get on with the rest of your life. The 11th and final law of love and relationships is the law of reality. In its simplest terms, it says, deal with people as they are, not as you want them to be. This law simply suggests that you don't try to change other people or expect them to change for you. Part one of this law says that to be happy, you must accept that people are what they are and that they're not likely to change. This is one of the most mature realizations that you can ever reach. Remember the words of that famous American philosopher, Flip Wilson, who, when he dressed up as Geraldine, would say, "What you see is what you get." Whatever another person is, that's what you get. People are what they are. People take an entire lifetime to become the individuals that you see before you, and they're not likely to change, even if they want to. In the absence of some traumatic emotional experience that causes them to seriously question their innermost beliefs and convictions, they'll be pretty much the same indefinitely. Part two of this law of reality simply says that unconditional acceptance of another is the key to a happy relationship. One of the deepest of all subconscious cravings that you or anyone else has is the need to feel totally accepted by another person or persons. Maslow placed this need for acceptance and belonging as the third basic need in his hierarchy. So instead of criticizing or condemning others, you should just accept them for the remarkable and unique human beings that they are. Most people don't realize that when they criticize another person or suggest that another person be different in some way, they're actually rejecting that other person and saying that he or she is not good enough for their standards. This triggers deep down feelings of fear, inferiority, and insecurity. However, when you unconditionally accept another person and make it clear that no matter what he does or says, you approve of him without question, the other person will feel terrific about himself, and it will dramatically increase the quality of your relationship with him. To close this session on love and relationships, let me leave you with one of the most important of all principles. It merely says that you get along with other people to the degree to which you get along with yourself. The law of correspondence in this case is absolute. You can never like or love anyone else more than you like or love yourself. You can never be more accepting or understanding of another person than you are of accepting or understanding yourself. So the very best way to improve the quality of your loving relationships, and the quality of your relationships with everyone for that matter, is to go to work on yourself. Since you're the only person over whom you have any real control, when you go to work on yourself, rather than trying to change other people, you can really make a difference. And you'll be amazed. When you become a better spouse, you'll find that your spouse becomes better. You'll be surprised at how much better your children become when you become better. The staff becomes better when the manager becomes better, and the customers become better when the salesperson becomes better. When you go to work on yourself and concentrate on becoming a better person through study and practice and reflection, every part of your human relationships will improve as well. You can make yourself into a superior human being simply by using all of your relationships and interactions with others as opportunities to live out the most important qualities you want to develop in yourself. You can become any kind of person you want if you are patient enough and if you persist long enough.